In 1982, when Bruce Holbert was a young man, he accidentally shot and killed a friend. This hour, that tragedy in the context of the current gun debate. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Bruce Holbert is a University of Iowa Writers Workshop graduate. He was raised in Washington State in a home full of firearms. And yet he came to see guns much differently than his father.
He always understood they were a tool, and I saw them as a symbol.
Bruce Holbert will also tell us about his new novel, Lonesome Animals. But first, the real-life story of an 8-year-old Iowa boy who brought a handgun to school. After this news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. 30,000 people. That's roughly the number of gun deaths in this country every year. Hundreds of those annual deaths with firearms are classified as unintentional, accidental. In just a few minutes, we'll talk with University of Iowa Writers Workshop graduate Bruce Holbert. In 1982, when Bruce was a young man, he accidentally shot and killed a friend. He'll recount that accidental shooting, how he coped afterwards. But first, if you're like me, you gasped when you heard this news a few days ago, the news of an 8-year-old Iowa boy who took a handgun to school in the Des Moines suburb of Johnston. Thankfully, the gun was not fired. Joining me to talk about that case and gun safety, Lieutenant Lynn Oswegen. He is with the Johnston Police Department. Lieutenant Oswegen, welcome to our program.
Thank you for having me.
How did your department first learn of the second grader with a handgun in school?
Actually, our school resource officer was contacted by the elementary principal informing our school resource officer of what they had discovered, and then our school resource officer responded to the scene.
Okay, and on the scene, what did officers find?
She first met with the school principal who was talking with the student who had brought the weapon into school. The student no longer had the weapon. He had turned it over to a teacher upon their request, so the principal directed our school resource officer into her office where the handgun and accompanying magazines were located, and she seized and took possession of those.
Do we know why the boy, did the boy say why he took the weapon to school?
No, he didn't specifically say. I think it was more of a child's play. He was only age 8, he wanted to apparently influence some other students by showing them the weapon, but he didn't really ever fully disclose what his intentions were.
Was the gun loaded?
Yes, it was.
It was fully loaded, all the rounds in it?
It was, but there was not a round in the chamber.
Wow.
It was an automatic handgun, but there was no round in the chamber, but the magazines were fully loaded.
What were the consequences of that for the boy? And we've learned his father had some consequences as well.
Well, I think the school is dealing with the child as far as disciplinary measures, and I'm not directly familiar what the end result will be on that. The father was indeed charged by our department for a C felony crime of neglect of a dependent person, and then a serious misdemeanor for making weapons available to persons under the age of 21.
What might he face as this process goes on? Where is that process?
To my understanding, he was to appear either yesterday or today on his initial appearance for those charges, and I'm not familiar with the outcome of that.
What might he have faced had there been a death, accidental or otherwise, at the school?
Well, I think I don't know that those charges would have changed any differently. His involvement was simply being irresponsible in maintaining the safety and security of his weapons at home.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, from time to time, we do hear about horrible tragedies. Thankfully, this was stopped before anything could happen. We do hear about children getting a hold of a gun. They think it's a toy, kill a sibling, a friend, or him or herself. Do mothers or fathers that you know of grieving the death of their child in these cases, in fact, get charged?
Yes, as far as my understanding. And again, we haven't had anything we've dealt with directly here within our area, but just through national media coverage and professional knowledge, it's not a comfortable situation, but it's one that ends up being the ultimate responsibility of the gun owner, and they can be subject to those penalties regardless of the circumstances that surround it.
I understand Johnston police took possession of other weapons found in this family's home that were not properly secured. In conclusion here, please give us some basics of storing guns safely, especially when children are around.
Well, I think it's pretty elementary for the most part. You need to keep them locked and securely locked and out of sight of any children that could potentially have access to them. We encourage people, you know, if you are going to have handguns in your home, make sure that wherever you secure them that the children don't know how to access that area. Keep those, whether it be keys or combinations to those locations, hidden. Keep your ammunition separate from where your weapons are at. And then the weapons themselves, we encourage to have a child-resistant gun locks placed on the weapons.
Lieutenant Lynn Aswagen, thank you very much for joining us of the Johnston Police Department. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Gun safety is our topic today. And my next guest, Bruce Holbert, has a particularly painful personal story of gun safety, a story he shared recently in an article he wrote for the New York Times. Bruce Holbert, welcome to our program.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
I want to mention that you are a graduate of the University of Iowa Writers' Workshop. In fact, you're the author of a 2012 novel, Lonesome Animals. We hope to get to talk a little bit about that in a few minutes. You currently, we're talking to you at your home in Nine Mile Falls, Washington State, and this is roughly the area where you grew up and where this tragic story in your youth took place. Would you tell us about the story of how you accidentally shot and killed a friend, Doug?
I was 22, and he was one of several college roommates that we lived together, and it was the summer, and we had a sort of tradition of meeting up at OMAC, which is where he lived, all the OMAC Okanagan area, and going to the OMAC Stampede and suicide race, which is it's a Indian tradition, actually. Several riders go off of almost a cliff, a 62-degree, jump onto a 62-degree hill on their horses and ride down the hill into the river and then cross the river and ride into the rodeo grounds. It's sort of world famous in the rodeo world.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so this is you're about to head out to there. It is August 1982. Mm-hmm. In fact, Friday the 13th, August,
yeah.
1982.
Yeah, and my friend Doug was doing an internship, I think there's a more precise term from that, but what amounted to an internship with the county police department there in the summer, between our junior and senior years of college. And he offered me his gun to examine.
And you're sitting in a, you're four of you are sitting in a pickup truck, right? You're in the back seat?
We're in a car, actually. And he offered me a gun to examine. I examined the gun. I thought I'd made sure that it wasn't loaded. And once I had made sure that it wasn't loaded, I pulled back the hammer and pulled the trigger, and it fired. And it hit him in the mid back or so.
He was in the driver's seat. You were in the back, right behind him.
I was in the back seat. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It hit him in the back, and he died. Within about 5 minutes, about when the police got there.
So and you were mistaken in thinking that it was unloaded.
One of the many mistakes I made that night, I suppose, was that I grew up with guns. In the New York Times article I talked about, I lived in a room with guns. It was the bedroom in the house where I lived with my dad, and I was very familiar with rifles, but had spent far less time with pistols. And when Doug handed me the pistol, I did what I thought was the proper procedure to make sure that it was unloaded, and I was wrong. I didn't know as much as I thought I did about pistols, and I had less experience with them. And, you know, and it was, the result was an awful lot of pain for an awful lot of people.
Mm-hmm. I don't want to dwell on it too much, but your first thoughts, those first moments after that shot went off, what were they like?
Well, I suppose disbelief followed by what do I do next? And there was a part of me that I think thought about running or trying to get away. And I think a bigger part of me realized that, you know, I wasn't going to get away from the worst part of this anyway. And so I guess the next step that I took was to try to revive Doug and keep him alive.
Mm-hmm. The police arrived?
Yeah. Yeah, they arrived and they asked who had been involved, and I was, I told them I had. They put me in the car, and I could see that they put Doug in a body bag a few minutes later, and that's when I knew he was gone.
What kind of shape were you in at that point?
I was undone, you know. I was sort of, I guess I'd describe myself as eviscerated, and I think I was eviscerated for 10 years. I still am to some extent.
I hear it in your voice. I'm sorry to have you talk about it, but we want to talk about gun safety, and you've had...
Well, part of the reason I wrote the article was when you get involved in something like this, you know, if there's going to be anything, you want it to be at least have some effect that isn't misery, and... Mm-hmm. One way to do that, I figured, was to tell my story and to maybe help people avoid the same situation.
There are a lot of accidental gun deaths in the United States every year, hundreds of them, I believe. In your case, you were charged, were you not, and the charges eventually dropped?
Yeah, I was charged with manslaughter, but it was, I believe it was one of those, you know, when they arrest you, they have to charge you with something. But I was never arraigned. My friend Doug's parents were the biggest reason why I was, why the case charges were dismissed. They were very adamant that this not ruin two lives. Or end two lives, at least. And they pushed very hard with the prosecuting attorney and with the police department to keep them from charging me.
Right. You said it took, what, 10 years to somehow cope with this. It's unimaginable that for any of us, thankfully, we don't have this experience to cope with it at some point. What were the biggest challenges you had to cope with in the mental anguish, I assume, and how did you finally find some sort of peace with it?
Well, I don't think you ever forget a thing like this, or I don't think I haven't found a peace with it. I think that what you can do is what happens is it sort of finds a compartment in your living and thinking. And when you visit that compartment, it's, you know, there's still a lot of turmoil and angst there, but you're not always in that place. You're, you know, you're spending time with your kids or your family or your wife or your work. And when you're doing that, it's easier. It becomes easier, I think, to leave that other stuff, at least in the background. But for about 10 years, I couldn't get it out of the foreground.
We're talking about gun safety, and, of course, that was one of the reasons, the current debate that's going on in across the country in Congress, one of the reasons you put that piece recounting this in the New York Times. I wonder, share your thoughts as you follow this debate over gun legislation in Congress. What should be done in the aftermath of Tucson, Aurora, Newtown, and the many other gun deaths in this country?
Well, I think that gun control is, to be honest, I don't think both sides understand each other very well. And I don't think that they're going to come to any kind of conclusion or any kind of an agreement until they find some middle ground. What happened in my incident wouldn't have been changed by any of the gun control laws that have been proposed lately. What happened has to do with something deeper, something cultural. In the country I grew up in, handling weapons is part of, it's a thread of what it is to be a man. There's an etiquette to it, you know, that when somebody shows you, part of when Doug showed me that pistol, there was an expectation that I admire it, and part of admiring it was examining it and, seeing how it functioned. And pulling the trigger is part of examining and seeing how a gun functions, you know. And my mistake was that I hadn't made sure that the gun wasn't loaded. There was one chamber that was empty, but the rest of them weren't.
Mm-hmm. But I'm wondering, you know, country to our north, Canada, lots of guns there.
Uh-huh.
Far fewer gun deaths than we have in the U.S., some over 30,000 a year.
Right. Well, I think that there are a couple of reasons for that, and I think one is that the Canadian mythology constructed around guns is different than ours. The mythology of the American West, in particular, is redemption through violence, and the way we tell the story to ourselves makes us more vulnerable or more likely to participate in either accidental or emotionally driven crimes with guns.
So what are you saying is the solution? If you say any of the legislation that you've seen or heard about is not a solution, what is it? So you're talking about a cultural change?
I'm talking about at least a cultural awareness. If I would have been aware then that the culture was working on me, it would have been easier not to handle the gun or to admire the gun from afar.
So take me back. If you had been aware of the culture working on you, take me back to that back seat. You would have done what differently?
I would have taken a look at the gun, realized I was unsure, less sure about pistols than I was about rifles, and that I didn't want to examine it any more closely, and and handed it back to him.
Well, you can legislate people taking training courses with guns to be aware of what they're capable of, can't you? That's legislation that...
Most people do take training courses, but there aren't that many training courses for handguns. I mean, there are some safety courses for handguns, but most of the guns that we were familiar with and that were rifles because we hunted. And... Yeah, I mean, you could have made me take a safety course, but the problem is that it's a story, and whether I've taken the safety course or not, if you're involved in the story of who you are, and if part of that story requires that you examine a pistol, even though you're not quite sure you ought to be, I think most people, especially men, will choose to examine it rather than to risk a disruption of the idea of whether they're men or not. There's a deep emotional tie. I mean, most of us grew up learning how to hunt with our dads, and a lot of that experience is really our strongest experience with our dads. Mm-hmm. And that thread is threatened when you threaten gun owners in particular. And the problem is there's no middle ground. Right now, the debate forces moderate gun owners into the arms of the NRA because there's no place for them to go.
But am I not right in saying that even many gun owners, if not NRA members, favor, for instance, background checks, universal background checks?
Sure. I think that's true. But the problem is that the political vehemence of the gun control and the tone of it, the gun control people, make gun owners sound like idiots. You'll find a lot of people who agree with what gun control, with people who believe in gun control. They'll agree with what they think. They'll agree with background checks. But when those same people identify their cultural heritage as, you know, savage and redneck, they're not going to be willing participants in any reform.
So they're identified as idiots in the tone, you feel, but also isn't part of this resistance that people fear, gun owners, some gun owners feel this is just the thin end of the wedge. Almost you get the sense they feel like it's the beginning of a conspiracy to take all guns away.
No, I think that's the NRA talking. I think gun owners are smart enough to know that unless they have a nuclear warhead and a stealth bomber at home, they're not going to be able to effectively organize a fight against the government. As a result, I think they understand the evolution of the idea of gun ownership, that is really not to protect us from the government anymore. And I don't think most of them believe that their guns are going to be taken away. I think that the loudest ones say that, but I don't think they believe it either. But I think they say that because it gives them political clout. I mean, you take a look at the NRA. The NRA has effectively, you know, close to doubled gun sales since Sandy Hook by amping up the fear.
So where do you see common ground? Where do you see this debate going? Where do you see it ending?
I think the solution is to move away from the extreme positions. I think that, yeah, it can be mitigated. I think that most gun owners would agree that there's no reason not to have a background check when you buy a weapon, and there's no reason not to require training. In fact, in order to get hunting licenses, you're required to be trained now if you're under 21. I think that that's middle ground that those people could move to, but they can't get there when the only political outlet that they have that they feel like supports them is way out in the right.
If you've just joined us, my guest is Bruce Hulbert, and we're going to take a short break and be back in just a moment with Bruce Hulbert. He is an author, a writer, in fact, a graduate of the University of Iowa Writers Workshop. When we come back, we'll talk about what his latest novel called Lonesome Animals has to do with what we've been talking about in this first half hour. Bruce Hulbert recently recounted his accidental shooting of his friend, Doug, when he was 22 years old, in a piece for the New York Times. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. My name is Ben Kiefer. Bruce Hulbert is my guest. He is the author of a new novel, Lonesome Animals, published in 2012, also a graduate of the University of Iowa Writers Workshop. And we're talking to him from his home in Nine Mile Falls in Washington State. And if you caught our first half hour, Bruce Hulbert talked about the topic of a recent piece in the New York Times where he recounted accidentally shooting and killing a friend when he was 22 years old. Bruce, you, in addition to being an author, you're an English teacher out there in Washington State.
Yeah, I teach what I like to call school-resistant students at Mount Spokane High School.
School-resistant, what does that mean?
They don't like school, and they're pretty convinced school doesn't like them. And so when they come into class, it's a they're kind of rehabilitation projects.
Let's talk a little bit about your novel and how it fits in with some of the themes we were talking about in the first half hour. Lonesome Animals, your novel, which came out in 2012. It's a Western novel, but also a detective story. It's set in Washington State in the vein of a story like True Grit or Blood Meridian. The main character and the anti-hero, his name is Russell Strahl, and I understand it's loosely based on your great-grandfather, who in real life was a legend among the first settlers of that part of Washington. Tell us about him.
Yeah, my great-grandfather came west and was one of the original homesteaders in the country down below where Grand Coulee Dam is. It's right across the river from the reservation now. And the place is still there. There's a road named after him and a canyon named after him. And his name was Strahl also. It's spelled differently than I spelled it in the novel. But he was pretty renowned. And so was my grandmother, who was a one-room schoolhouse teacher. And in the winter, she would get in a sled and go to a single sort of centrally located home and teach there for a couple of weeks, and then she would go someplace else and teach for a couple of weeks. But motivation or the connection to the book is that my great grandfather murdered my grandfather.
Murdered your grandfather?
Yeah.
What's that story?
My great grandfather was getting older, and my grandmother and her husband decided to move home and help him take care of the ranch. And in that process, it's not unusual for there to be bitterness when that occurs, but in that process they had some sort of disagreement, which was serious enough for the county sheriff to come out. And when the county sheriff came out, my great-grandfather shot my grandfather with a rifle, and then actually the sheriff was wounded too.
Your grandfather was killed.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And my grandfather and my great grandfather ended up in Monroe Prison, where he died about 8 or 9 months later.
So tell us about the real great-grandfather on which you based the fictional anti-hero, Russell Strahl, the connection there. What did you take from your real-life family ancestry to put in this novel and create a character?
Well, I think, you know, if you talk about, if you consider the event in the New York Times that I described and that event in my own personal history with my great-grandfather, you can see that I'm going to have had quite a bit of opportunity to reflect on blood and death. And nobody knows much about my great-grandfather. My great-grandfather was, I remember when I was 4 or 5 years old asking my grandmother, well, where's my grandfather? And she just said, well, he's dead. But, you know, nobody explained why, and it was one of those secrets that sort of hung over the house until later on when my dad started talking about it a little bit more. But there just isn't much information about him other than, you know, those events and a little historical referential stuff.
Mm-hmm. How old were you when you found out that your great-grandfather had murdered your grandfather?
Well, for certain, probably about 22, 23,
the accidental shooting took place.
Yeah, about the time when I killed my friend. And I think that maybe part of my dad wanted me to sort of... I guess maybe he wanted me to, I guess to see that I think maybe he thought there might be something cathartic about it.
Or comforting in a strange way?
Yeah, that he was giving me, he was letting me in on the secret. And that would be how my dad would approach things. He's not terribly direct.
Was it, in fact, any sort of comfort?
No. I mean, but it wasn't any, it didn't add to what I was dealing with either. It was knowledge. Later on, I think now it's become a clearer part of my sort of worldview.
How so?
Well, it's for a couple of reasons. The thread of violence in the West that I think a lot about in my writing is obviously connected there, and also the idea of manhood. My dad grew up without a father or a grandfather, and I didn't realize it until looking back. He had to guess at a lot of stuff, and he sort of had to get, as far as a male influence in his life, it was really the Western story, the Western myth that was the primary influence, because he was surrounded by other kids his age, men his age, who were influenced by it. And so the lack of comfort that I felt sometimes with that myth, I think, was the same kind of confusion that he felt. He was a wonderful father and is a wonderful man, but he never felt sure of himself as a father. I think that he had doubts because he didn't have any template to go back to.
And yet, is there a connection there with the way you were raised? You said you were raised in a house full of guns.
I was, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So do the plentiful guns have anything to do with insecurity about fatherhood, or am I taking that too far?
No. They just have to do with the fact that he was interested in guns. I mean, he lived on a ranch and did a lot of, he shot deer for food for the family, and he just got interested in them. And it's a way that in some ways musicians collect guitars, and it was a tool, and he liked, he liked nice weapons. I mean, he liked how they functioned. And that was a big difference between him and me, was he always understood they were a tool, and I saw them as a symbol, as a metaphor. And that was probably had something to do with me mishandling the weapon in a situation with Doug.
Bruce Holbert is my guest, referring to the accidental shooting. He shot his friend Doug in 1982, shot and killed his friend, and he has, in the meantime, become a writer, a graduate of the University of Iowa Writers Workshop, author of the 2012 novel Lonesome Animals, also the author of an article recently in the New York Times which recounted that killing of his friend in 1982. Give me some more about your novel, Lonesome Animals, and the connections we see here. First of all, perhaps a synopsis of what you have going here without having any spoilers.
Well, it's a novel about a guy like my great-grandfather who was an Indian policeman, and basically he's a violent guy. And that's worked for him. But he's been sort of put out to pasture. He's too violent for... He calls himself a mean guard dog with nothing to guard, because the country settled down, and it's during the building of the Grand Coulee Dam in the 30s, and he's kind of going to seed on his homestead when he's approached by the new sheriff to hunt a serial killer on the reservation. And And so the novel is about him hunting that serial killer and encountering, you know, people that he's had experiences with and dealing with his own violent nature that even he knows is immoral but was functional in the early days. You know, he's, the situation kind of forces him to confront himself.
How much of that accidental shooting, the influence of that accidental shooting in your real-life story is a part of this book? In what way does it surface, if at all?
I suppose the idea of the myth, he's living by an old Western myth, as Strahl is. He's living by an old Western myth, and what's happened is the country's become too civilized for the mythology. And as a result, what he used to do to get acclaim now, you know, isolates him because people don't want to have to deal with him. So he's kind of lived longer than his story has, and I think in some ways that's a little like the gun story. In some ways, our culture has passed that gun myth by, but we're still participating in it. I mean, time has passed the gun myth by.
So you're saying the gun myth was once useful but is outdated, like Russell Strahl?
Yeah, a little bit, yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think that the other element is the element of violence. It's a very violent book. People wonder why, and part of what I was trying to do, I think, was to push the violence beyond the sort of typical violence as redemption in Westerns that we're familiar with, and to make it horrific, because I think that's probably more accurate, that the violence was horrific and was performed by horrible people, not typically heroes.
Mm-hmm. But it is interesting because with your background, having shot a friend in 1982, it would be perfectly understandable, in fact, almost expected, that you would try to ban guns from your life and not have anything to do with them. Instead, decades later, you write a novel full of violence and guns.
Yeah. I suppose it's because it's a way of me to continue. It's a way of me continuing to try to wrestle and understand what happened, not just to my family, but what happened in the accident that I was involved with so many years later. It's a way for me to continue to try to figure out how this place in which I've lived for so long functions.
I wonder if you have in your life had contact with other families who were part of accidental gun deaths or intended gun deaths.
I've had contact with families who, kids who, I'm a teacher, so you know, like students get involved in accidents, and I've had, you know, I've sort of tried to serve as a semi-counselor for those kids at times, or at least somebody who's shared similar experiences. But as far outside of that, probably not very often.
Mm-hmm. So I thought maybe it was, perhaps would be cathartic or therapeutic if you would talk to other people who had accidentally killed someone, as you have.
Yeah, it might be, but I feel like, to be honest, I feel like the writing process has been more cathartic than anything else.
What was a cathartic moment in the writing? Where were you? Can you remember a passage that really made you realize something?
I can't remember a particular passage, but I remember having this sense that I was on to something. Part of the reason I write is to sort of explain things to myself. I don't really know what I think or mean until I write it down. And then, you know, as I was writing, it was like I was explaining this larger context in which the accident with Doug occurred. And so I was seeing it from a clearer and more distant perspective.
In the writing of this book, did you talk with others in your family or in Doug's family that were involved in that in any way?
No, I talked to my dad some.
About what?
Well, about my great-grandfather and about also about just other, you know, kind of anecdotal stories about the ranch and about just that country. And, you know, he can remember riding the ferries that don't exist anymore, things like that.
Mm-hmm. And you live in an area right now where you're actually kind of in the wild or at least can enjoy the wilderness.
I've got some room. I live in about 6 acres on the edge of a river, and you know, it's a nice combination because it's still close enough to town that the kids can get to their friends pretty easily.
I don't want to keep you too long. I know you have to go back to class. It's good that you stayed with us so long. But I want to get your thoughts on your time in Iowa City as part of the Writers' Workshop. You were in the University of Iowa Writers' Workshop from during 1988 through 1990. Tell me, what stands out in your mind as a memory that has shaped you as a writer or the city?
Well, Iowa City is beautiful. Every fall, I just think of it's like, geez, this is nice, but it's not Iowa. Aside from that, I would say I just grew so much during that period. I mean, I was such a rube when I showed up, but I just encountered so many intelligent people and interesting, talented people, and they were willing to become my friends was sort of shocked me. and they have been friends for years and years, and wonderful teachers. Alan Gerganis still influences my life, as does Jim Salter and Jim McPherson and Frank Conroy. I mean, they were, you know, I still hear their, you know, I still hear a sort of resonant kind of perspective from them sometimes when I'm asking myself questions about my own work.
Mm. So tell me, let's go back to your anti-hero, the hero you have created in your work of fiction, Lonesome Animals, loosely based on your great-grandfather. As you described him a few minutes ago, I was getting definite pictures of a motion picture, and I was wanting to get your take on if it would become a film, who would be Russell Strahl?
Well, I've had people suggest Tommy Lee Jones might fit that character pretty well, and I can't really argue with that. It's hard for me to say, you know, film is such a different medium than literature is for me. It's film is all visual or primarily visual, and literature has to do, for me anyway, has to do with the sound of the words. And so it would be hard, it's hard for me to think in those terms. But, you know, somebody who could make that character come off as tortured in a way, but also brutal in a way that's not forgivable.
If not images, what about music? Does a musical score or a type of score from the past come to mind when you think of how that might be?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Marty Robbins, Gunfighter Ballads, and some of George Jones's stuff. I mean, he when he died recently, it was like a death in the family for me and my dad. Let's see, Lefty Frizzell, Hank Williams, all that, you know, country stuff.
All right. We'll let you get back to your classroom. Thank you for joining us this hour. Bruce Holbert, the author of the novel Lonesome Animals. You're a high school English teacher there. Your class is waiting for this conversation to end so you can get back to them, huh?
Yeah. They've just finished a reading assignment. They're reading some Krakauer. So
John Krakauer?
And it's one of those things that kids can dig into. And so now we're going to go talk about climbing mountains.
climbing Everest.
Yeah.
Well, you thank them for allowing us to share you this hour and take a little class time away from you. I'm sure you'll make it up. Bruce Holbert, thanks for joining us this hour.
Thanks very much for having me, Ben. I really appreciate it.
Well, then let's go out with a little bit of George Jones. The title of this song is called Choices.
I guess I'm paying for the things that I have done. If I could go back, oh Lord knows I'd run, but I'm still losing.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Technical support from Dennis Reese. While I've got a moment, I want to say goodbye to our help in Ames for technical support, Alyssa Weiss. She's graduating, moving on to greener pastures. Thank you so much, Alyssa, for all the help you've given us during the time that you've been with us here at Iowa Public Radio. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Make good choices, and thanks for joining us.
I wouldn't be here today if you've been dying with the choices I've made.